Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Robert Mueller spoke publicly this morning. He announced that he's closing the special counsel's office and resigning, that the office's work is done, and that the words of his report should speak for themselves. He said he does not want to testify before Congress, and he said the circumstances needed to be investigated. His quote was, "If we'd had confidence the president didn't commit a crime, we would have said so." You can find ongoing coverage throughout the day, both on the air and at capradio.org. Now we're going to move to an investigation focused on sexual harassment training within California state agencies. Cap Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd has published his compilation of the numbers in these agencies that are in non-compliance, and more than half of the agencies fall into that category from last year. Scott joins me now in the studio. Hi, glad to have you here.
Good morning, Beth.
I want to start by establishing a few basics. Who exactly are we talking about that's required to have this basic sexual harassment training?
So state law requires that private employers with more than 50 employees and all state agencies provide sexual harassment training to supervisors. For new hires or promoted supervisors, they need to receive this training within 6 months. And then on an ongoing basis, every 2 years, the supervisors need to receive an updated sort of recurring training.
It's not optional, correct? This is the law.
According to the law, it is not optional. No, this training needs to be provided.
I think it's important to add some backdrop to all of this, and that takes us back to 2017 in the midst of the national Me Too movement, and that's when the We Said Enough campaign began. And the goal of that campaign was...
Well, it was to draw attention to the issue of sexual harassment and sexual assault in some cases in state government. Over 140 women signed an open letter calling out the issue of sexual harassment, specifically in state, the state legislature. But it went beyond that as well. They said there is a toxic culture in state government that allows this to persist, that sees this happening and that turns a blind eye towards it. And it was pretty remarkable to see this many people, this many women signing on to this letter, but also the women who signed on to it were very influential women who were calling this out, and they called it out in very stark terms.
So their ongoing goals include changing laws and changing policy. And here we are with a look back at 2018. And there were agencies that were, and many that were not, following through on this basic requirement of the law in terms of sexual harassment training. How many didn't meet the requirement?
So last year, it was more than half of the agencies surveyed. They surveyed 17 agencies. 9 of them were out of compliance. The previous year, it was around 30% that didn't comply. And then the previous year was about a quarter. So in total, it was dozens. It was in the dozens of in recent years that have not provided this sexual harassment training.
Let's go into some of the specifics. Let's look at which ones and how many supervisors were not trained.
Sure. The big one that jumps out is the Department of Corrections. They failed to train nearly 700 supervisors. It's worth noting that they're also one of the larger agencies that the State Personnel Board surveys. They have about 8,000 plus supervisors. So it's a very large department, mm-hmm. but again, a very large number of supervisors who were not provided training. The Department of Healthcare Services, they were surveyed just this year in the upcoming report that'll be out later this year that's under progress right now. But they failed to train 230 supervisors out of about 720. The Department of State Hospitals, they failed to train 150 out of about 870. So those were some of the ones with the highest numbers of supervisors that were untrained. But there were some smaller agencies, too, that failed to train a couple dozen. Some failed to train all of their supervisors. And those were usually the ones that are a little on the smaller side, though.
What are some of the reasons given to you about why the noncompliance was happening?
So I was able to determine this through requesting the corrective action plans that these agencies need to submit to the state personnel board. Each one that's not in compliance has to submit a plan to say, okay, how are we going to improve this? And it's my understanding they're not required to say what caused the noncompliance, but some of them do offer that. And what I could see is for a number of them, it was a failure to track this training. Hmm. Some simply just didn't have a tracking mechanism in place to see who was being trained, who still needed to be trained, and whether or not they were up to compliance. Some also had pretty lax tracking methods. The Department of Industrial Relations, for example, they said that they tracked their training on an Excel spreadsheet and manually updated it. That's not exactly the most sophisticated way to track something like supervisor training. And then there were also issues with personnel. One department said the individual who oversaw training and compliance, that role had not been filled for several years. And so training just started to slip through the cracks. Mm-hmm. So I saw a range of different reasons. I think the one that that was most clear, though, was a failure to track or just very lax tracking methods.
Who's reacting with surprise to this? Scott, what kind of feedback are you getting on these results?
I'm getting a mixture of both surprise, but also sort of disappointment, but not that surprised, if that makes sense. For example, Samantha Corman, who's one of the co-founders of We Said Enough,
right.
She's also a fairly high-profile consultant in town. When I presented the findings to her, when I interviewed her for the story, she said, you know, this both surprises me and it doesn't, because she has seen this so much in state government. I think what surprised her was that she hadn't seen this before, that this didn't come to light when a lot of the Me Too revelations were kind of reaching a fever pitch last year. Mm. This is something that hasn't been discussed as much. And in the story, I talk about how in the legislature, the legislature was a lightning rod for this issue, but not as much was discussed on the regulatory side or on the agency side of state government. So I think that's where people are surprised. I think they believed that a lot of this had been aired out, a lot of this had been discussed, but the reality is a lot of the discussion happened on the legislature side. Not as much was happening on what's going on over at the regulatory agencies.
I'm talking with CAP Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd, and I want to get to what can happen as a result of supervisors not receiving the appropriate training.
One of the clearest things is creating an unsafe work environment. I spoke with Suzanne Ambrose. She's the head of the state personnel board. And she had this to say about what can result from lack of training.
Supervisors who aren't aware of those requirements or don't know how to identify sexual harassment aren't, you know, we can assume they're not in there proactively addressing it.
So what you're hearing there is the state personnel board head saying, if you don't receive training, a supervisor really is the first line of defense. You know, they are the ones who are in there observing who is facing this harassment. They're in there identifying it or should be identifying it. So if someone doesn't receive this training, that's crucial for them to be able to identify those things. And beyond that, if sexual harassment is occurring in the workplace, one of the things I heard repeatedly was there's a risk of legal liability. Hmm. If someone brings a lawsuit, if someone brings a claim against a state agency, that can result in very high cost payouts or settlements. So without this training in place, this, you know, 2-hour training, you know, once every 2 years, that can result in some very costly legal ramifications as well.
The question is, who's in charge of enforcing this law? I've been in workplaces where the HR administrator will be the one to make sure you know that you have a certain training module to complete and that the tracking is done sometimes digitally in a way, if it's an online course, for example. I imagine the tracking happens differently agency to agency, but overall, what is the oversight?
So there are kind of multiple levels, multiple layers of oversight. And when there's that kind of structure, sometimes it means that it's really ironclad. Sometimes it means that things start to slip through the cracks. In this situation, I would say it's more the latter. The agencies themselves are responsible for tracking the training. Obviously, that's been somewhat of an issue, but a number of them have said that they've adopted a more sophisticated tracking system. But beyond the agencies, the State Personnel Board provides these audits every year, but they don't have an enforcement mechanism. They don't have, they're not a policing body. They identify these issues and then they leave it up to the agencies to fix it. And the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, they are the ones in the letter of the law who are tasked with enforcing this, with actually making sure that the agencies comply. But the director of the department told me they don't have an adequate way to essentially compel agencies to follow this law. They have the ability to issue violation orders, but he said that they've never issued a violation order against a state agency for failing to comply. And that's not because clearly no one's everyone's in compliance. That's not the case. What he said was that they have a very difficult time determining who is not compliant. And he said it usually rises to their attention only after someone files a sexual harassment complaint, which seems backwards, right? The sexual harassment training is meant to deter and stop sexual harassment from occurring in the first place. But it only becomes clear for the Department of Fair Employment and Housing that someone isn't providing this training until someone claims they're sexually harassed.
It could also point to another point that I know people make in this is whether the training really works. There are a lot of people who might say, great, it's good we have it. Others who say, it doesn't make a difference. So we're just going through a rote motion here.
And there were several people who brought that up in my conversations as well. Actually, that department director, the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, he said, you know, the training in concept is very important, but he said in practice, what's being provided, he said it's not very adequate. He says it needs to be improved, which I think is a fair point. I think many people would say that's not a reason to abandon it completely. That's a reason to improve it. And in that director, actually, they're producing training materials right now. And he said, I'm happy that we're doing this because we have a little more control over the effectiveness of these training materials.
You did talk to an assemblywoman who has been working on this concept for a long, long time. And in fact, I think she's still taking legislative action to try to enforce compliance.
Well, so she was the legislator who introduced the law back in 2004. It went into effect in 2006. So it's been on the books for a very long time. I think it's worth noting that this law predates the Me Too movement. This former legislator, she actually termed out, but it's still very much something that she is concerned about. And that came through in my conversation with her. She had said to me that she wants to see the legislature take action on this, that she doesn't want them to just sit back.
I would appeal to the legislature that they shine a light on this, that they audit these state agencies and they bring them before them and say, why have you been out of compliance?
Okay, there's that piece of thought, but then add where the governor is on all this.
So I spoke to, or rather I reached out to the governor's office on this, and I was somewhat surprised to hear their response simply because this hadn't come up in any of the conversations I had elsewhere. The governor's office said that this is something that the Newsom administration took notice of pretty much upon Newsom entering office, shortly after being sworn in. They noticed that there was lack of compliance at these agencies. And they said the administration directly reached out to agencies and said, you need to get into compliance. This isn't an option. And they told me that they expect near or full compliance by July. And again, it was news to me in all the conversations I had about sexual harassment training compliance. This had not come up. So it was very, it was interesting to hear this. And it's something that I'm starting to look at. I'm looking into further to see what exactly these actions are that are coming from the governor's office.
That definitely sets the stage for some follow-up reporting.
Absolutely.
This has been a powerful group of pieces. I will again tell everyone that your stories and more background on this issue of sexual harassment training and compliance in California government can be found at capradio.org. And I thank you for joining us today. I think even if you aren't hearing a lot of feedback, the fact that this kind of conversation is ongoing for the people that initially were bold and outspoken 2 years ago has to be satisfying.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It's an important topic, and I think it's a reminder that while there's been a lot of discussion of this in the last year or two, it's still an important area for us to look at.
That is Scott Rodd, Cap Radio's state government reporter, and you're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.